From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we go to Philadelphia to have a conversation with our favorite analyst in Pennsylvania, the entire state, and perhaps the United States of America, Professor Tony Montero from the Saturday Free School in Philadelphia. And we're going to discuss in this 100th anniversary year of the founding of the Communist Party of China, the recently closed last week, sixth plenum of the 19th Congress of the Communist Party of China. Professor Montero, welcome.
Hi, how are you, Don? Good to be with you.
Doing okay, and it's great to have you with us. So fill us in. What happened over the days of the sixth plenary session of the 19th Congress? What is it, first of all?
Yeah, this is a very interesting thing. You know, the 19th Party Congress was held in 2017. Between party congresses, by the way, the congresses in Communist Party organization are the highest decision-making bodies of the Communist Party. Between congresses, and by the way, the 20th Party Congress, which will be in 2022, is coming up. But this, between party congresses, the constitution of the party requires that there be seven plenums. Now, a plenum is a plenary session, a general session of the Central Committee of the Communist Party. Delegates are the highest decision-making body between congresses, and there were about 320 or thereabouts delegates and alternate delegates at this plenum. According to the Constitution of the Communist Party of China, the party is required to have seven plenary meetings of the Central Committee between Congresses. So this was the sixth.
What's the frequency of the Congresses and who attends those? That's the highest decision making. It's a much larger group, yes?
Yes, far larger. As you know, the Communist Party of China has somewhere close to 90 million members. It is a huge party, its congresses are made up of delegates elected by party bodies to be delegates to the congresses. Communist Party congresses, I don't care whether it's China or the United States, or Iceland, or Cuba, or North Korea, are very important events. Unlike conventions, party conventions that we have every 4 years in this country, which are defined by hoopla and merriment and partying, and then along the way, they might choose who their presidential and vice presidential candidates will be and come forward with a platform that nobody pays attention to. For Communist Party, congresses are highly significant events. The 17th Party Congress was a very, well, frankly, I'm sorry, the 19th Party Convention was a very, very significant event. The 18th Party Congress in 2012 was very significant because it elected Xi Jinping as the General Secretary or top leader of the Communist Party of China. The 19th Party Congress, and this plenum, the sixth plenum of the 19th Party Congress, was very significant because it established the thought of Xi Jinping as the guiding theoretical framework for this period in the development of socialism and democracy in China.
What does that mean, the thought of Xi Jinping? How do they describe it?
Yes, this is very interesting. And frankly, I would say this is very unique to China and the political culture of China. The first time that the thought of the leader of the Communist Party of China was enshrined as the guiding theoretical, ideological, political approach to the solving of problems facing the party and the nation at that particular time. The first time this was done was in 1945 at the Party Congress then that established the thought of Mao Zedong as the guiding thought of the party in the period of the Civil War, of the establishment of a People's Republic of China, of the ending of the semi-feudal, semi-colonial status of China, and the beginning of the building of a new democracy and of the first stages of the building of socialism in China. So they say that the guiding thought of the party is associated with the thought of the top leader of the party. In 1980, with Deng Xiaoping becoming the leader of the party, they then, looking back, it seems, have defined the period of 1980 up until 2012, more or less, as the period of the thought of Deng Xiaoping, of reforming the economy, reforming the political system, and what they call opening up to the world. And now this period is being defined as the thought of Xi Jinping. In other words, the task confronting the party and the nation and the people are guided by a set of theories, assumptions, ideological predispositions, political approaches, etc., by the thought of the main leader at that time.
So we're talking about something that would be analogous to, like, the policy behind, or the stated policy and perhaps the policy framework for an administration in the United States that maybe was not completely constrained by the existing legislation, but allowed innovations across both the political sphere and the economic sphere and the social sphere. Is that right? This is kind of an organic thing that, you know, we're going to try a new approach to things this way, that way. It comes out of the analogy to the White House, although the feed is from the bottom up. But it's something that is administered by the person whose thought it's being ascribed to. I mean, they don't actually have a tin hat on him with wires connected to it, downloading what his thinking is. It's an expression of policy, yes?
It's more than that. It's far more than that. And frankly, there's no analogy to Western democracies and political parties in the West or in the United States. I think the first thing, you know, when we talk about these thoughts, the thought of Mao Zedong, we're talking about something close to 35 years of an epoch, an era in the party. Deng Xiaoping, similarly. These are long eras of practice and theory and problem solving and policy. I mean, it's kind of all of the above. But the thing I think that we have to understand, that as much as possible, and this goes for, went for the Soviet Union, it goes for China, it goes for Cuba, it goes for North Korea, probably for Vietnam, socialist societies are planned societies. Now, that doesn't mean that everything can be accounted for or anticipated, but we're talking about a framework for an epoch, for an era, for a period in the history of that nation. We have nothing analogous to it in the United States or in any so-called Western democracy. There is no planning at that level. But the socialist societies are politically and economically planned societies. The question is, China now, as a result of the sixth plenum, this recent event, believes that they are at a new level of perfecting the planning and organization of the work of the party, the work of the state, and the work of the nation as a whole to move forward. That's the way I would put it. I don't think we can speak of analogies with America, the White House, or, you know.
I got you.
by the way, we could say a lot about the White House these days, right, and the split between Kamala Harris and Joe Biden and the two or three factions competing there.
Well, you could start with questions about whether there actually is any thought in the White House at all to ascribe to anyone.
As they say, true. That, you know.
So meanwhile, so we're looking at, you know, this has been, it's the 19th Congress that, you know, is wrapping up now, with the 20th beginning next year. The first was in July of 1921. This is when the party was founded. And in other words, the party was founded in the wake of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. And as a matter of fact, some of the original founders of the party were among the first in the world and in China to publicly support Lenin and the idea of revolution there. Then they saw the October Revolution in Russia as groundbreaking. And so, you know, we're looking at something, the trajectory was set off by the events in the Soviet, in what was then Russia, the Russian Empire, and it's followed its own trajectory to the point that you just described, where, you know, they seem to be coming to a point of full maturation of this revolution.
Oh, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And that is why this plenum is so important, because it occurs in the 100th anniversary, the centenary year of the founding of the Communist Party of China, which, by the way, we commemorated here in Philadelphia with a three-day conference. We felt that the 100th anniversary of the founding of the Communist Party of China was epic and world transformative. And in spite of the ups and downs and conflicts and mistakes of the Communist Party of China, it is probably the greatest, most significant political party in the world today. It is, and you know, the other thing, like you said, there's not very much thought in the White House. Compare Xi Jinping to Joe Biden or Barack Obama or George. I mean, Xi Jinping is a bona fide intellectual as well as a political leader. And right, that quality can only be produced by a very mature party, by a very developed leadership. So that's what we're looking at.
Yeah, yeah. And it's quite an apparatus that the party sits on top of also. In many ways, the largest economy in the world and growing at a rate that the rest of the world really can't compare to. Not fully expressed. You know, we're looking at, a potential, I mean, we have just a domestic market of almost 2 billion people in terms of labor, in terms of consumption, in terms of, you know, creating value, whatever, however you want to approach it. The potential, you know, had the growth of it has been set afire and is, you know, burning brightly. And the sunset of that is nowhere in sight. So some amazing things have yet to come. And all the amazing things that have already happened are historic in their character and scope.
Oh, yeah. It's very important, especially the economic questions as China transitions from an export-driven economy to developing its own internal domestic socialist market. In other words, they have to, again, I use the word perfect, managing a socialist market economy that the plan and the state cannot manage every aspect of the lives, the economic lives of 1.4 billion people. So you have to find creative ways to modernize and at the same time to contextualize most economic processes, or I would say the vast majority, the most strategic economic processes within the framework of a directive plan that can be checked up upon, can be critiqued, and so on and so forth. It's very different, and a lot of people get this wrong. The capitalist free market is not the same as the socialist market economy. A lot of people think when you use the word market, oh, you're talking about capitalism. That is not true. The question that makes the distinction between the two is what forces control the commanding heights, the dominant and strategic parts of the economy. And as we see, as Xi Jinping announced a year or so ago, the whole idea of a common prosperity, evening out inequality or doing away with inequality as they did away with poverty, and all of this, you cannot even talk about that unless you have the capacity to plan for the future. The capitalist market does not allow for that. The socialist market system allows for that.
You know, you look at some of the statistics in the economy. Looking at the growth in GDP, for example, you've had in 2018, 6.7, in 2019, 6.0. 2020, the year of the great COVID depression, when everybody shut everything down, and China was the focal point of this at the beginning, their recession consisted of growth at only 2.3%, which rebounded to 8.5 in 2021. So actually averaged out, it went down to 4.7 or something for the depression year, where there was a major contraction in the West. This is a fire that's still burning no matter what you throw at it, basically. And in every measure of how the people are living, the Gini coefficient is 46.7, which is very high when last measured in 2018. That's before the additional 11% growth in GDP in the intervening 2 years. Human Development Index is 0.761, which is very high in 2019. And just about every marker of how people are doing there is very high.
Oh, yeah. And see, the other thing is when polls are taken, even by Brookings or Western or American polling institutions, over 83, upwards of 85% of the Chinese people say they are satisfied with their government, which means that the Chinese people see their government as legitimate and working in their interests. Now, this is very significant. It's not just an indicator that the people are satisfied. But unlike the United States, where 83% of the people say the government does not serve their interests,
yeah.
Positive ratings for the Congress is in the low 20s. The highest lawmaking body in the country is in the low 20s. And the president of the United States, not even a year into his presidency, is in the mid to high 30s in his approval ratings. Well, what these indicate is that in China, there is no sharp class division and class struggle. In the United States, on the other side, there is a deep and deepening class division, political division, and class conflict in the United States, which is an ongoing and permanent feature of capitalism, especially in this moment of crisis. And let's not get it confused. We are in a crisis. They want to soft ball it and that type of thing. This inflation might be long-term and almost permanent. And to get it under control would require one of two things. One is to get the big banks and the Federal Reserve and Treasury under control. That would relieve inflation from the backs of the people. The other, which is probably the course that will be taken by the Fed and the Biden administration, is to allow the people to pay with an extra tax of higher prices. But that is not the case in China. But I want to talk about something else that is significant in this sixth plenum, and which makes it quite unusual. And that is the fact that it has done only what has done two other times, has been done only two other times in Chinese history, in 1945 and in 1980. 1945 with Mao Zedong, and in 1980 with Deng Xiaoping. A summarization of the period out of which the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese nation are coming, the 100 years of the history of the party, and what they are saying. In good times and bad times, the Chinese Communist Party has proven its ability to lead, has produced leadership which has ideologically and scientifically defined the task of leadership and the task of the nation and the people. And this is very important because they say that now we are beginning the next 100 years of China, and that in a decade and a half, or a little more, maybe two decades, that China will have arrived at the stage of a moderately prosperous nation. They achieved one of the great 100-year objectives, which was wiping out poverty and extreme poverty. And now they're looking forward. It is very encouraging at this time of crisis, and crisis in the economies, and crisis of war provoked by the policies of the United States, that there is a political organization on this planet that can look forward, that can see a way out of the climate crisis, that can see a way out of poverty, that can see a way out of inequality. And so this is what is deeply encouraging. This is a unique political party with a unique vision for its society, and it makes it clear all the time that they're talking about socialism with Chinese characteristics, and they're not trying to say that their model is the universal model for all nations and all societies in the world.
So at the fifth plenum last year, they adopted the 14th five-year plan, which you're referencing, and it says, this was looking from October of last year China becoming, as you said, a moderately developed economy by 2035. What that means, in you know, in terms of numbers, they plan on tripling the per capita GDP in the next 15 years. That's remarkable. That's right. It's now approximately $10,000. These numbers are kind of meaningless because, you know, currency prices, all different things, and actual real economic things too. China doesn't have to ship the stuff it consumes halfway around the world like the stuff we consume gets shipped halfway around the world. There's a certain fundamental economic reality that things are cheaper that they make for people there than they are here because they don't have to be shipped, you know, across the planet, 12 time zones away. But they're going to triple the per capita income in the next 15 years on their plan, and they've been on the money with the last 13 plans prior to this one.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's quite extraordinary. And were it not for war provocations from the United States, and especially the Biden administration, and especially these two guys, Anthony Blinken and Jake Sullivan, who are ideologues trying to act like diplomats or were it not for military spending, Chinese economic development would be much quicker. By the way, they might create the paradigm for societies attempting to go from to transition from fossil fuels to sustainable sources of energy. They're not going to, you know, like do it all at once, like COP25 claimed they were doing or didn't do.
Right.
Or want, you know,
or Paris.
Right.
Remember Paris.
The fact of the matter is that to go from a fossil fuel based economy producing its energy, as China must be because it is still a developing country, to go to a green economy requires a transition. And I'm certain that China will not ever accept this inflationary policy where it would cost, according to Janet Yellen, anywhere between $130 and $150 trillion
right.
over the next, quote, 30 years
right.
to green the global economy.
Right.
That is nothing, and let me just make this point clear. That has very little to do with climate and greening the world economy. That has everything to do with the great capitalist reset. They're
right.
trying to use the climate situation to reset, to remake capitalism, and it will take them, according to their estimates, $130 to $150 trillion. Let me just say that would set off inflation the likes of which not only in human history no one ever saw, but no one could ever imagine. Inflation that would create political turmoil in the Western economies that would make it virtually impossible for the Western system to survive. That's my estimate.
And the working class living within that Western system, for sure. That's
the point, Don. I think the Chinese, what they're saying is that these are tasks. Every epoch, every era presents humanity with certain tasks to be addressed. And they are trying to address them scientifically, intelligently, with a certain amount of calmness and maturity, unlike what is going on in the United States in particular.
Thank you very much, Professor Montero. It's been a pleasure discussing this with you. And we will speak with you again next week.
Thank you so much, Don.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.